Why should I trust the Gospels? Well, some, I guess, will be bemused by the question. It seems even a pointless question. Church is about the spirituality of being with a group of others who share a real faith in God and coming together and sharing that. That's all that matters. I mean, the Gospels, they're a comforting source of inspiration, perhaps, but trust doesn't really come into it. But others will actually be very perplexed by this question. Perhaps that's why you're here tonight. You know, you've perhaps heard academics tear the Gospels apart, particularly on historical grounds, and the anxiety is that there just isn't a credible defense against some of those questions. And, you know, you fear closer scrutiny, that it'll bring the whole house of cards tumbling down. So it's a question best avoided. And then thirdly, and hopefully there'll be another group of people here who, well, they're just dismissive of the question. Should I trust the Gospels? Of course not. Don't be a moron. This is what the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, put it. This is how he put it. I wonder whether this is going to work. If I press the button, there we go. There he is. He said, the authors of the Gospels were unlettered and ignorant men, and the teachings of Jesus have come to us mutilated, misstated, and unintelligible. Can I trust the Gospels? Well, absolutely not, according to Mr. President. Or perhaps you go as far as Richard Dawkins, who said back in 1998, we should devote as much time to studying serious theology as we devote to studying serious fairies and serious unicorns. In other words, none at all. History seems irrelevant to faith. It's got nothing to do with it. Just as people think that religion has nothing to do with truth. Religion is a private, it's a personal thing. Faith is more like an opinion, they tell us. It has nothing to do with the realms of fact. This is why people sometimes try to distinguish between the Jesus of history, the one who lived, and the Christ of faith. You know, all the sort of baggage that people heap onto that historical figure. But the things that people choose to believe about this figure. They distinguish between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. But here's the surprise tonight. History, facts, public reality, these are in fact central to Christianity, as we're going to see. Why should I trust the Gospels? Well, because ultimately, if we don't, there are no grounds for the Christian faith at all. It becomes something other. And, you know, people have done that, and you're free to do that. But it's something other than historic Christianity. It's that simple. But, of course, this is a huge issue. And people devote lifetimes to studying. I just brought a selection of a few books here that I have on my shelf. If you want to come and have a look at them afterwards, feel free to do so. I've just got 30 minutes. And often when people ask this question, I think there are probably sort of six related elements to the issue, to the question. And often I find that if I start tackling just one of them, skeptics rebound very quickly with one of the others and say, but what about X and what about Y? And I'm saying, well, I'm still dealing with this. Give me a chance. And in a sense, that's what I would love to say tonight. Just be patient. Just give me a chance. And I'm by no means going to cover every sort of item under each topic. As you can see, you could stretch almost infinitely into thinking about each of these questions. There's much more to say on each of them. That's partly why I've given these handouts, and at the back, at the bottom, you'll see some ways of following up both books to buy downstairs in the Resources Center, but also there is just loads of stuff online. And just for ease of argument tonight, I want to divide up these six into two groups of three, what I would call sort of internal pointers for evidence, and secondly, external pointers. So let's think about the first trio, the internal ones, inside the Gospels themselves. What reasons do we have to trust? Well, the first is going to seem rather weak and pathetic to you, because the first reason to trust the Gospels is simply that they tell us to. Big deal. Talk about circular arguments. You know, trust the Bible because the Bible tells you to. That's not exactly an argument, but just bear with me a moment. Let's look at that conclusion to John's Gospel that we read. Look at the claims that John makes for his book. And the interesting thing is that this, while they're not identical, they certainly correspond with what the three other gospel writers say and are doing. So here we have it again, verse 30. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples that are not recorded in this book. So he's been selective. He's quite upfront about that. He's being selective. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John had a clear purpose in writing. And there's a sort of process. There are four parts of this process. The first is very clear. He tells of these signs. John is a record of these signs. He's been selective. He doesn't do all the signs that Jesus made, but these are the ones he's chosen. And, you know, signs is John's word for miracles. The miracles that Jesus performed. We'll come back to that in a bit. And he's recorded more than miracles. There's teaching, there's the sort of relationships he had with people, as well as some of the things he did. And the ultimate conclusion of it all is, of course, Jesus' death and resurrection. That is where John is heading in the story. But his purpose in telling all these things is because he says they are signs. And what do signs do? Well, they point the way. So these signs point, secondly, to Jesus' identity. Do you see there? He is the Messiah, the Son of God. Now the interesting thing is, those two terms, Messiah and Son of God, pretty much mean the same thing in Old Testament culture. They are both titles for the king. So in a sense, King David was one of the great Jewish kings. He was understood as a Messiah, a Christ. He was anointed king. He was the Son of God. And so what John is saying, these are signs that you might believe that Jesus is the king, the cosmic king. In fact, he is the great king of kings, God's king over the whole cosmos. It's quite a claim. A massive claim. Yeah, that's what he says he's doing. That's the heart of it. And why does he tell us these things? Why do these signs point to this person? Well, because he wants us to trust him, to believe in him. Trust, belief, it's the same way, same thing. To put our trust in him as not just the king, but my king. And in John's gospel, towards the end of the whole book, that's precisely what one chap, a chap called Thomas, does. He bows before him and says, my God and my king. God wants us to do the same. But there's a final stage in this process that John explains. And the fourth is, as a result, we will have life. Life in his name. Now, of course, you're listening to this, and by definition, that means you're alive. I mean, you look pretty alive, most of you. And so that's not quite the sort of life he means here. He's talking about life that extends beyond death. Life that starts now but goes on beyond death. Or another way of putting it, it's life after life. Just as Jesus rose to life after life. And John is saying, we can have that too. We can follow this king beyond the grave. And he's saying, not only is he the king of the cosmos, but he offers you life. He wants us to trust him for that. Now, that is a humongous claim, isn't it? That's huge. And before anybody's going to swallow that, they're going to have to do a lot of thinking and sifting and debating and chewing over these things, of course. And that's precisely what John wants. That's why he's written this book, so that people will do that. But here's the big ask. You see, the amazing thing is that the New Testament, the writers of the Gospels, know the stakes very well. Just near the top of the sheet, don't bother looking it up in the Bible for now, but Paul writes to the Corinthian church, and this is one of the earliest documents in the New Testament, so within 20 years of Jesus' execution, Paul writes this: if there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised, and if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. In other words, if this is not true, we should pack up now. It matters that this happened in history. This is a clear appeal to historical reality, isn't it? Saying, this matters. It matters that it's true. Now, neither Paul nor John have any time for those who reduce faith to just a private matter of opinion. This is public reality, a matter of truth, of history, of evidence, of reality. And so, if you cannot trust that the Gospels point to that reality, then we've got rather a huge problem, haven't we? The claims are there. The consequences of those claims are pretty huge. The stakes are very high. It really matters. So the question comes, can I trust the Gospels? It's not enough simply to be told by the Gospels, trust me. Why should we? Many people object to it. They don't want to be taken in. Nobody wants to be conned. Nobody wants to be gullible. We want to use our minds. We want to think this through, and I hope you will. So let's just think about some of the objections to this idea. And the first is a simple one. People say, well, look, you can't trust the Gospels because, quite frankly, they are not consistent. In fact, they're even contradictory. Hopelessly contradictory. Well, let's think about this. There are many different angles we could take on whether or not they're consistent. The first obvious question is, why do we have four, not one? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Why do we have four? They certainly offer different perspectives of the same thing, but they do seem to contradict each other, don't they? And, of course, if we just had one, there wouldn't be any contradictions at all. There wouldn't be a problem. Much easier. Take, for instance, the recent party political conferences with the leader's speeches. And, they were big news. All the big papers and media outlets were covering them. And so you would expect, for instance, the Guardian and the Daily Telegraph to cover the same events, but to say very different things about the speeches of Ed Miliband and David Cameron. You would expect that. In fact, if they didn't differ at all, if they were identical, you'd be pretty suspicious. You'd think there was a bit of a stitch-up, which is pretty unlikely between The Guardian and The Telegraph, but you'd never know. And, you could read these two accounts of the leader's speeches at the two-party conferences, and you could recognize they're talking about the same event. You would recognize what is going on and say, yes, okay, they both talk about that, but their interpretations of these events are going to be very different, contradictory even. But what about the Gospels? Well, we have four. That's quite interesting. And one of the things we do know is that they use different sources. I can say more about that in questions afterwards if you want to come and talk to me. But basically, in a way, the more records we have, the better, isn't it? That's a good thing. And we don't want it to be a complete stitch-up. We don't want them to be identical. That would be alarming. But if there are differences of tone and color, what's the difference between that and then actual contradictions? Aren't there real contradictions in the Gospels? Now, of course, I haven't got time to go through every single one and every single dilemma, and I guess, you could, if you know them, you could come up with one or two, and they might be some that I'm familiar with, others that I'm less familiar with. I'd want to research them and so on. But we need to understand what we're dealing with here before we look at details, and I'm always keen to look at details. We need to understand what we're dealing with. We can't apply modern standards of historical accuracy to texts that are 2,000 years old. That's very unfair. No historian expects it of any other document. And the Gospels are not biographies in the traditional modern sense. They're not day-by-day timelines. They're not chronologies. They have a purpose. They have a message. Some people use this to berate the Gospels, but actually they are completely upfront about their agenda. They want people to believe. Everybody who writes anything has an agenda. And the Gospels are up front. They're not hiding anything. They're quite explicit. They want us to believe. Does that make them biased? Not necessarily. Does that make them have a perspective and an agenda? Of course. So what? And so because of that purpose, because of wanting to communicate a message, they might sort of round numbers up and down to, get a nice round number. That's pretty common. Or they might leave certain details out that another gospel has kept in. Fair enough. They might even actually play around with the order of events. This is something that troubles people sometimes. The order of events. So, for instance, you could call that contradictory, but actually I think it often involves legitimate literary convention and decision. So let me give you one or two examples. Different order? Well, in Matthew, Matthew describes Jesus sending the disciples out on a training trip in Matthew 10, and that is after he has calmed the storm in Matthew 8. However, in Luke's gospel, it's the other way around. He's changed the order. And then there are other sort of differences. So, for instance, some of the content is slightly different. So, for instance, you know, Jesus is very famous for his parables, the great stories he told. You know, you might know some of them, the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, all these stories. And for some reason, Luke loves the parables. He has more parables than anybody else. And so most of the really famous ones come from Luke's gospel. But John's gospel contains no parables at all. Not in the same sense that we use the word parable for Luke. Does that mean they're contradictory? Or just different interest and emphasis? And what about sort of the manner of teaching? Well, for instance, in Mark's gospel, it's the shortest of the gospels. The way that Jesus does his teaching is very often in short, sort of pithy sentences and paragraphs on the road as they're walking and talking. And he says the kingdom is like dot, dot, dot. Whereas in John's gospel, it tends to be sort of longer, extended periods of teaching. Is that contradictory or just a different way of doing it and a different arrangement of some of the teaching and chapters? Now, I think that's perfectly common for instance, even modern preachers to sometimes use the same story in different contexts with a different punchline, perhaps. That sometimes seems to happen a bit with Jesus' stories. Or the way he talks might be very different as he's walking along the road chatting. Would be very different from how he might take a seminar after meals. Everyone sitting around and sitting comfortably, and there he begins. Extended periods of teaching, so what? In fact, the interesting thing is, the gospel accounts do read like something more than just the descriptions of a life. They actually feel like eyewitness accounts. Lots of incidental details that don't need to be there. And if they were faked, all the sort of wrinkles and awkwardnesses that are genuinely there in the text, all of those would have been ironed out. The great C.S. Lewis was a literature scholar at both Oxford and Cambridge, and his last job was professor of medieval and Renaissance literature. And he said this, "I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they are like, and I know that none of them are like this. Of this gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, in other words, eyewitness accounts describing what has been seen and experienced, or else some unknown ancient writer, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative," which only really began a millennium and a half later. Now, there's much more to say, of course, but suffice it to say that they do read like the accounts of people who saw and heard these bizarre events. Now, that's not to claim that Luke or Mark themselves saw them. John and Matthew clearly did, but Luke, for one, is explicit about consulting others. He's not ashamed to say, look, I wasn't an eyewitness, but I talked to those who were. But the point still stands. The sources are eyewitnesses. But hot on the heels of this question comes the next one as we go round our circle, and that is the issue of the circulation and transmission of these texts. How do we know that what we have here is actually a translation of what they wrote? Now, it's impossible to give a sort of categorical dating to each of the Gospels. On the inside of the booklet, of the sheet, I've given one estimate of the chronology of when each of the New Testament books was written. It's a bit of a guess. But this we can say without any hesitation whatsoever about these documents. They are unique in ancient literature. Pete Williams on that little video clip touched on this. But they are unique in our confidence in their accuracy. Now, how can I say this? Well, my first degree was in classics, in Latin and Greek. I know that's weird. Just deal with it. But I had to read all these guys like Homer and Euripides, Cicero and Julius Caesar in the original Greek and Latin. That was what we had to do most days. And the earliest text we have for those books, well, you can see on the back of the sheet some of the facts and figures of the transmissions. And I'm putting it on the screen as well. You can see that the gap between when it was written and when our earliest copy of that text actually ranges over not just centuries, but sometimes over a millennium. And yet, for many of these texts, we can be reasonably sure of what we're reading. But with the Gospels, it's just a different ballgame. We're not even in the same zone with the Gospels. These books were quickly copied and passed around wherever the church spread. And it spread like wildfire in the first century, didn't it? All over the then known Roman world and beyond. And we now have, as a result of digging things up and sort of pots and pans that contain them, basically we've got little snippets and copies of different parts of the New Testament from all round the Mediterranean. So, you know, a little piece might be dug up in France, and then you can compare that with another piece that's dug up in Libya. And, you know, the British Museum, the British Library have got all kinds of copies, as well as many other libraries around the world. And many of these are now online as well. And what is staggering is to compare them and to see how little the changes were. They're minute. The odd preposition. Or perhaps one person has someone's name, another person might have their full name. But invariably, the key meaning has not changed. And the contrast with ancient texts is startling. So let me just show you the sorts of pain I used to have to go through when I was at college. This is a page from one of my favorite plays by Euripides. It's called The Bacchae. And it's an amazing play. It's a tragedy. It's quite a cheery subject, actually. You'll like this. It's about a queen who becomes part of this sort of intoxicated group of women in the city of Thebes. They go on a rampage and then frenziedly kill her son, the king, with their bare hands. And the mother rips the son's head off. And so the play ends. And it's lovely. Okay, so this page is from near the end. And what I've highlighted there, you can see the sort of blue thing, that's just got lots of dot, 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 because the text is missing and we have no records, no manuscripts at all of those lines. So we know there's something missing for whatever reason, and basically they just put dots. We don't know what it was. And then in the bottom, you'll see the footnotes there. I've sort of ringed that in sort of pinkish. And basically that gives a whole range of alternatives for those verses in the play. So this is right near the end. Now compare and contrast that with Luke chapter 23. Here's Luke, and you'll see you've got footnotes there, but actually the footnotes are doing something slightly different. The very bottom set, they are looking at cross-references, so that's nothing to do with the text. The next set up is looking at all the manuscripts that agree with them. So each manuscript has a little code, which is usually two letters or whatever, and it basically says, these manuscripts have it like this. And basically, you see, they're just a long line of them. And then I've highlighted something in blue there, which is one textual difficulty with Luke 23. And basically, this is the time of Jesus' crucifixion in Luke 23. And basically, you either have the text saying the sun was eclipsed, or you have some text saying the sun was eclipsed and the sun was made dark. And the bit in blue adds the words, the sun was made dark. So basically, it's repeating the same idea. And some texts don't have that, and so it's left out of the standard text, because it doesn't add anything to the meaning, does it? You're either saying the sun is eclipsed, or you're saying the sun is eclipsed, and it went dark. Big deal. It means the same thing. Now, in fact, the modern translations that we use here at All Souls, the New International Version, the NIV, one of the things I like about it, as well as a number of other modern translations, is it has nothing to hide, and if there is ever a textual problem, it'll say so in the footnotes. So I always make a point of looking at them to see where there might be a problem with a particular passage. It's got nothing to hide. And the staggering thing is not that there are one or two difficulties. The staggering thing is how few there are. And, you know, there, I could compare lots of other pages where actually most of the page is taken up with footnotes rather than the original text, but not with the New Testament. I've got it here in Greek. You can come and have a look at it for yourself as well. In fact, I think this is a staggering thing that we just need to recognize much more. So one scholar, Stephen Neal, who was a professor in various places, said this: we have a far better, more reliable text of the New Testament than any other ancient work whatever. And the measure of uncertainty is really rather small. Anyone who reads it can feel confident in almost everything of importance. He's close indeed to the text of the New Testament books as they were originally written. Now again, there's much more that needs to be said. Don't take my word for it. Check it out. Look it up. So far, so good. So we've been thinking about the internal and claims and evidence for what the Bible and the New Testament says. Well, we've got a reliable text written by eyewitnesses. But the good news doesn't stop there. What about the external evidences? Well, the historical evidence outside the Gospels. This is interesting. Let's suppose that what we have here is reliable, it's true, it's an eyewitness account. Let's just assume that, just for the sake of argument for now. These are pretty major things being talked about. You would expect an impact of some sort on the ancient world, wouldn't you? You would expect that. If these things are true and they happened, you would expect sort of footprints, if you like. So, for instance, if I wrote on my blog a post about having seen a force of 50 Challenger tanks driving across Regent's Park, you'd be quite impressed, especially if I had a photograph and I put it on. So there it is. But, of course, anyone can Photoshop these days, so that's not quite enough. What you would really need to be impressed is to make a visit to Regent's Park and just witness the devastation, the flower beds, the trees trampled, you know, grass under tank tracks and all the rest. Then you would really know that there had been 50 Challenger tanks across Regent's Park. Why they were there, I have no idea. You'd expect a footprint. Well, some claim that Jesus left no footprints whatsoever because he didn't exist. That's what the late Christopher Hitchens said, and many others seem to follow his lead. But I have to say that very, very few ancient historians, whether they're Christian or not, accept that. It is widely attested that there was a man called Jesus from Nazareth. That is not in doubt. And that is because his historical footprint can be found, even in hostile or neutral witnesses. So I've included on your handouts at the beginning, number two, there is corroboration in other ancient historians. One of the most significant was a Roman senator, Tacitus. Very important for understanding the early years of the Roman Empire after it became an empire from having been a republic. Tacitus was a senator as well as a brilliant writer. His writing style is very impressive. Then there was a Jewish historian who was also part of the sort of Roman smart set, Josephus. Those are probably the key ones. There are others as well. And they both talk about Jesus and his followers and the impact they had on the early years of the church. They made waves. Some writers get Jesus' name wrong. So Suetonius, who's mentioned there, he calls him Crestus. But it's clearly talking about the same person. And the fact that Tacitus mentions Jesus and the early church is fascinating, because what we forget is that Judea was like the armpit of the Roman Empire. Nobody wanted to go there. It was complete bywater. It wasn't the center of all the action. Basically, it was just, you know, a nuisance on the side. The action was happening in other places. And just think of, you know, the Roman Empire covered the whole of the Mediterranean. Think of all the different sort of local news issues that were going on in Tacitus's time and that he was writing about. Plenty of other things. It's remarkable that he mentions this Jesus figure at all. More interesting to me is the sort of incidental and circumstantial evidence. In other words, moments when the Gospels unintentionally fit with what we now know. So Luke describes early on the three provinces of Palestine, each with its own Roman ruler. And he gets their names right compared with Tacitus. Or his mentioning of a rebellion by a man called Theudas. And Josephus talks about that, giving much more details. Oh, big deal, you think. By themselves, they don't amount to very much. But Luke doesn't need to tell us about those things. And yet, when he does mention the details, he gets them right from what we can tell again and again. And there are difficulties. There are questions. There are some that really, you know, make the head ache a bit. But that's true of everything in life, isn't it? follow it up. There are a couple of great books downstairs in the Resources Center. This one I really recommend by Paul Barnett. It's quite new. He's written loads on this topic, but this is the latest version. It's called Gospel Truth, Answering New Atheist Attacks on the Gospels. Really helpful. As well as this other little booklet, cheaper, briefer, but get to the point, can we trust what the Gospels say about Jesus? Follow it up. You can find the whole of Josephus on the internet, in English, fortunately. And Tacitus. Look up Tacitus. Type in Jesus. See what Tacitus says. But what about actually digging stuff up? What about archaeology? Now, of course, we're not going to find Jesus' actual footprints because, you know, there are a lot. Pretty difficult to identify which were his. But there are plenty of instances of archaeological corroboration of in what is now Israel. And I'm no archaeologist at all, but again and again, archaeology confirms what the Gospels say. Sometimes they're tiny details. Let me just give three little ones. Sometimes archaeology actually proves the skeptics wrong. John's Gospel describes Jesus' healing at Bethesda, where he describes a place with five porticos. And for years, people thought John had just made that up. You don't get anywhere with five porticos. I mean, if you know anything about the classical world, they loved rectangles and straight lines and things in order. And yet, sure enough, in the 19th century, they found this pool in the right place with porticos, like a big oblong, but with a portico going across the middle, making it five. And then there's corroborating evidence that corroborates eyewitness. So again, in John's Gospel, we find that Jesus' execution occurs at a place called Golgotha, and in John 19, we're told it's outside the city walls. Now, the interesting thing is, if Jesus had been executed just 10 years later, new walls were built, and Golgotha would have been inside the city walls, which suggests that the description of this event is by someone who was there at the time who would know that at that time it is outside the walls. It's just a little indicator. It's not huge. You can't sort of build everything on it. But it's just a little indication that we're dealing with an eyewitness account. Why mention it otherwise? And then actual places are verified at various points. So, for instance, Capernaum, this tiny little village on the north side of the Sea of Galilee, is near Jesus' hometown where he grew up. And basically, it was a tiny little place. The only significant building there was, well, by the 4th century AD, was a synagogue. What is fascinating, there's a picture of the synagogue that's left, which is dates from the 4th century, but archaeologists have dug underneath it and found that there was a synagogue there in the 1st century in Jesus' time. And the Gospels tell us Jesus went into the synagogue in Capernaum. Okay, it's not a big deal. You're not going to build a whole sort of system on that. But yet again, what gets dug up reinforces what the Bible, the Gospels tell us. Jesus existed. So what if we have eyewitness accounts, though? There is one elephant in the room that I cannot avoid forever. And it's the last point to make. What about the miracles? I mean, the biggest objection in the end, I mean, the problem with these being eyewitness accounts is these just miracles. Doesn't make sense. So basically, because they describe miracles, many people assume before they even begin, or you can't trust them. But actually, that's a presumption, which in some cases may even be a prejudice. The prejudice that says miracles don't happen. Miracles don't happen. Dead men don't rise. Well, if you read John or Luke or anything else like with that sort of mindset, then of course it's a foregone conclusion. Your mind is made up before you've even opened the book and basically it's sorted. This cannot be an eyewitness account simply because these mad, crazy things are described. And so you'll come to maybe a story like the feeding of the 5,000. And some commentators will say, well, of course Jesus didn't do a miracle. How ridiculous. Of course, what happened was this little boy brought up his food and he shared it with everybody else, and everybody else was ashamed by their stinginess, and because he had shared, they suddenly decided they were all going to share. That has honestly been suggested as an explanation for how 5,000 plus people could be fed at once. But what that reveals is a closed mind to the possibility of the miraculous. What makes you so sure? What makes you so sure that dead men don't rise? If dead men did rise, what would convince you they did? Or are you so sure that they don't? And of course, the real sticking point with this is the resurrection itself. You see, as I've said, everything depends on this. If Jesus is not raised, then our faith is useless. The interesting thing is, something happened 2,000 years ago. If you just miss the resurrection, you have to come up with a plausible explanation in its place. Because something happened. Where else did this church come from? What caused that? You know, some will dismiss the resurrection as a sort of a conjuring trick with bones. But that really won't do. Here is scholar Tom Wright speaking about this. He's currently research professor at St. Andrews University. He said this, the early Christians did not invent the empty tomb and the meetings or sightings of the risen Jesus. Nobody was expecting this kind of thing. No kind of conversion experience would have invented it. No matter how guilty or how forgiven they felt, no matter how many hours they pored over the scriptures. To suggest otherwise is to stop doing history and to enter into a fantasy world of our own. Nobody could have expected or invented this. And the fascinating thing is the Gospels make it very clear that they really didn't get it. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the Gospels that lends credence to them. The disciples come out pretty badly. What happened if Jesus was not raised? Now, some people think that, you know, those in the ancient world, they weren't as clever as we are. They were pretty stupid, otherwise why believe this sort of nonsense? But I think we'll find, if you examine the history and look at ancient texts, you'll find they were as skeptical, if not more skeptical than we are. And if you think the ancients are stupid, I challenge you to try and understand the philosophy of Socrates and the poetry of Virgil, and dare I say it, Paul's letter to the Romans and the Gospel of Luke before you suggest it. They're not stupid. Different, ancient, but not stupid, not gullible. There is evidence for the resurrection. Some of these books contain it. You can find more downstairs. It does stand up to scrutiny. And if Jesus did rise from the dead, then the other miracles surely cease to be a problem. John promises that if you follow the sign of Jesus' resurrection and trust him as cosmic king, you'll have life beyond life. Because he rose, we'll rise. Well, you've been very patient. I've gone on far longer than I was expecting, and you were hoping. Too much to take in. Please follow it up. Do that. Go to that Archaeology Explored event coming up. Check out Christianity Explored. But there's one piece of evidence I've not mentioned as I close. That's the evidence of countless millions around the world who trust in God's King. Not everybody is an intellectual. Not everybody has studied the ancient history and the details. And for them, it wasn't important. They trusted it because they've got to know this Lord Jesus. It's impacted their life in completely unexpected ways. Where others did investigate these things. And for them, they found that it did bear scrutiny. But in the end, it doesn't really matter whether you're intellectual or sporty and not intellectual, whatever it is. The end result has got to be the same. To do what John wants us to do, which is to trust that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing, we may have life. I'm going to close with the words of a very unexpected theologian, a chap called Lee Mack, who's a comedian who was on Desert Island last week. This is what he said, because if you know about Desert Island Discs on Radio 4, basically people choose 8 pieces of music and they're automatically given a Bible and Shakespeare plus a book of their choice and a luxury item. But Lee Mack said this about being given a Bible. He said this, I'd like to get the Bible because I'd read the Bible. I think it's quite odd that people like myself in their 40s are quite happy to dismiss the Bible but have never read it. I always think if an alien came down and you were the only person they met and they asked, what's life about? And you said, well, you see, there's this book here that purports to tell you everything. Some people believe it to be true, and some people don't believe it to be true. And the alien goes, wow, what's it like? And you say, oh, I don't know. I've never read it. It would be an odd thing, wouldn't it? Now, I've no idea what sort of aliens in the region are up to at the moment. But it's good to be prepared. To the very least, we should read it. And I think you can't say fairer than that. Well, let's have a moment of quiet, and then I'm going to hand over to Paul as we sing our final songs.